I wouldn't support this bill.
Good morning. I will call to order this meeting of the House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee. A little bit later, we'll be joined by our colleagues in the Senate for the veterans issues. We welcome the senators who are willing to come and be part of the first half of the meeting. So, thank you very much. And my goodness, we have a house full this morning. That's great. We're going to jump right in, I think. The first hour, we're going to talk about emergency preparedness issues in general. If you'll recall, at the last interim committee meeting, we started through a process of talking to some of the various agencies about our emergency preparedness plannings and strengths and weaknesses and what we might be looking at. And there's also been a little bit of an issue pop up in between that the Public Health Division has addressed and made some changes. And Dr. Melcon is here this morning, would like to explain all that to us. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Cowan, members of the committee. Thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to talk with you this morning. I'd like to just share with you some of what we've been doing in our, what used to be called our hospital preparedness program, but that we are now referring to as our healthcare preparedness program, trying to broaden its scope just a little bit. This program originally started in the months after 9/11 and the anthrax attacks, when there was a lot of concern about our ability to respond to bioterrorist emergencies. And gradually over time, the scope has broadened to include other kinds of emergencies. And the funding that came from our federal partners really came in two main streams to public health, anyway. One stream that was focused on community preparedness, and the other that was really focused on hospital preparedness. We, at that time, the decision was made to set up the system in a way that we thought would engage our hospital partners best. We hadn't been working with many of them for very long on these kinds of issues. Actually, we hadn't been working on these kinds of issues in some ways ourselves very much. So we were all learning together. And the way this hospital preparedness program initially was set up was quite decentralized. We had around the state seven HPP, that's what the initials we used to refer to the program, seven HPP agencies, regional lead agencies we called them, whose job it was to pull together the partners in their region and essentially decide how to distribute the funds that were allotted out to each region based on the number of hospital beds and the number of people who were in those regions. I think that was a wise decision at the time as we got the program started. And we ended up with kind of a very heterogeneous structure around the state. In some cases, the regional lead agency was the local health department. In one case, it was a health system. And in, I think, two other cases, it was a hospital in the region who sort of took the lead in pulling the partners together and making this happen. A lot of good work was accomplished, but frankly, over the last few years, we started to hear concerns being raised about, well, who was really running the show? Did everybody in the region have an appropriate opportunity to bring forward their needs? And was the state somehow favoring the regional lead agency over some of the other partners in the region? And all of these kinds of discussions. Now, during the influenza pandemic that thankfully is now over, we had an opportunity to test a lot of these relationships, and much of the good work that had been done laying the groundwork really, I think, was very, very helpful for us. But that experience also exposed some of the problems we had with the structure of the system. There were times when I felt from the state perspective, I was hearing concerns about things that were happening in hospitals, and I didn't have staff that I could easily kind of deploy to some of those hospitals to do some of that problem solving, who had the relationships and so forth, because the staff that were running each of the regional lead agencies were actually reporting to that agency and not to me. And of course, everybody was so stressed to try to convince somebody to, well, you know, lend me some of your staff when your emergency room is exploding. That was a very difficult kind of discussion you could imagine to have. So that was one concern that got raised. In addition, the fact that we were so hospital-focused, what about the other parts of the health system, the primary care offices, the emergency medical system, and so forth? So our staff, of course, you know, we are in the preparedness world, we function under the incident command system. We have the mindset is one, and this is a good thing, that's very, you know, kind of command and control kind of thing. And of course, they had, our staff had some very clear ideas about how we should plow forward, but we really needed to do a lot of work to bring everybody in and get all of the good ideas that they had about how we should restructure ourselves to solve this problem. So, last year I asked a consultant to help us do that. He went out and performed over 300 interviews with partners around the state and gathered input on all of these questions and more. What was working with the system? What wasn't working? And really, how do we take what was quite a good system, but how do we really take it to the next level? He issued this report, which I did not bring copies for you today. I'd be happy to get it for you if you're interested, or I can send you the electronic link as well.
I think the committee would prefer the electronic link, if you would.
Sure.
Thank you.
And there were a number of key findings that I just want to share with you, and then I'll tell you what we did to implement those findings and where we are. One of the questions that had been raised was the regional configuration that we use the right one? The Office of Emergency Management has its regions. In the public health world, we were used to functioning with the Area Trauma Advisory Board regions, which were a little bit different, and the ATAB regions were based on the referral patterns in each local area, which hospitals had been working with each other and so forth, and it was the ATAB regions that we had used for our HPP regions, just to make it equal, even more confusing, of course, there were 9 ATAB regions, but we only had 7 HPP regions. I know that the arithmetic is a little messy there, but so we had to combine some of them. So that was one of the questions that was asked, and I think what we heard from our partners was, no, the regional structure really works very, very well, and we shouldn't disrupt those terrific relationships that had been built. The second issue that popped up was this question about the regional lead agencies. Who should the regional lead agencies be? I've already described to you some of the input that we've gotten. And, you know, in the context particularly of the budget issues that we're all facing, another trend that this program had faced is both declining federal support for the program. I believe the program has declined about 10% or so over time. Of course, costs for personnel and everything else are increasing. And there was kind of a gradual creep up in each of the regional lead agencies of the overhead costs that so the system that we had set up was costing us a lot of money to maintain. And so we really wanted to ask the question, was there a more cost-effective way that we could do that? And the recommendation of our consultants was that we change that system, that we eliminate the regional lead agency structure, and instead use a smaller number of state staff who would be positioned out in the field to maintain the relationships that were out there and do some of the same, essentially those same functions of convening the partners, the decisions about how the monies in each region would be spent would still be locally based decisions that these partners would make, but the kind of convening and tending functions would be state staff. So that was the second major recommendation that came forward. There were also some very important issues around communication and leadership from the state. I think that what we actually heard from folks was a desire for us to be a little bit more directive, quite frankly, and try to set some more standardization across the regions in terms of the things that they were spending the dollars on. And also that we needed to do a better job of coordinating things within public health. So was the hospital preparedness program talking to the community preparedness program folks in the community who are actually based, the coordinators for those are based at local health departments. So we really wanted to solidify those links and make them stronger as well. So those were the major findings from the consultant. And you could imagine as this played out, you know, there anytime there's change, there's a lot of anxiety, rumors were flying. But we made the decision based on the data that we collected to change the structure of the program. We did indeed keep the regional structure the same seven regions that we had, but we did change we did eliminate the regional lead agency structure so that the staff became state staff, and also we're in the process of hiring those folks at this time. Now, there was one exception to this change in the structure that we made that also aroused some controversy, but that I think was the right decision for us to make. And that was, we did that change in structure in all of the regions save the metro area region. And the reason for that difference is that, there were several reasons actually. One was the complexity of the system in the metro area it's much more complex. There are more hospitals, about 40% of the hospital beds are there. And I was concerned, frankly, about our ability at the state to take on that whole part of the system along with all of the other changes that were going on. In addition, I think the needs are different around the state, and we wanted to be responsive to the different needs that we were hearing from our partners in the local areas. So that, of course, you know, did arouse, you could imagine, quite a bit of discussion. But I think most of our partners, if not all of them, have come along, and we are in the process of hiring staff. In some cases, it's the same staff people who have just moved over. They get their paycheck from a different place, and in some cases not, depending on the specific area. And we also will be convening an advisory committee in November to better help us run this program, and this is going to be an ongoing activity. And one of the questions I want this advisory committee to look at as well is whether this decision to leave the metro area region as it was before the change is something we should continue, or whether they should that structure should change as well. So, you know, this is a complicated process. There are a lot of players involved. And although we have a little bit of funding with which we can help move the players down the road together, we really do depend on the goodwill and cooperation and good ideas and input of all of the partners who are out there. So I want to make very sure as we go down this road that we're continuing to do that. So far, I think once we got over the initial decision, I think things have been going quite well. I will continue to keep you all informed, and if you all hear issues raised by your constituents around any of this, I would be very interested to hear those and talk about them with you as well down the road. The one other thing I'd also like to mention, in addition to calling out the leadership of my own staff, Dr. Larry Mullins at Samaritan Health System was particularly helpful through this process. He was really a state leader around this, and I'm very grateful for the input and counsel he gave us as we went through this process, and I hope that he's going to be a very active participant in our advisory board as well. So with that, I'll stop, and if you have questions or comments, happy.
Thank you. I will note that Dr. Cohn called me and June, I believe it was, to make sure that as soon as I started hearing all of this stuff that I should know what was going on. So I appreciate that heads up. And we decided that we'd just sort of see how things worked out and then make sure that we brought you back to this meeting so that we could update everyone on what the status was. So with that, questions? Representative Boone.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Cohn, I just want to thank you for not applying the broad brush stroke to this issue, because you're absolutely right. Different regions are going to have different needs, and it's always best to let the locals kind of guide that. So I will hope that you'll invite him back for December meetings to update us if necessary.
I think we'll see what the timing is, as appropriate time-wise. So I'll let Dr. Cohn be the guide of when he thinks we need to hear more.
Okay. I hear from, follow-up, I hear from one particular person in my district who keeps me upgraded on what's happening. She's very involved and was integral to the success of our surviving the floods and storms and everything. And this person works for the county and is very, very dedicated to the work, and I'm sure that she'll be a great asset to you, too, in our region. So, thank
Perfect.
You.
Perfect. Thank you.
Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is really maybe too early to even mention, but Fairview is looking at having the USS Ranger docked in Fairview. It's a huge aircraft, and part of what could be there is a hospital for emergency services. And when we were oriented to that, I mean, it was unbelievable what that could be. Anyway, I just wanted to put that on your radar. It's several years down the road before it'll come, but we're in the process.
Thank you. That's an interesting update. We've heard several times about the USS Ranger, and downtown Portland didn't seem to be working out real well.
Port didn't want it.
So that may be a better solution. Other questions or comments? I think I would just like to throw a sort of a separate piece in, but I know that your department is involved. There's also been an emergency healthcare task force meeting around emergency rooms and how patients with certain critical medical issues might best be, we might best get them to the most appropriate facility in the most timely manner, I guess. I think that something will move forward from that work under Senator Bates' direction. And the conversation is around regionalization there as well, as is in many of the worlds that we talk about in terms of the provision of EMS and a variety of things. So I'm just hoping that all of these things can stay coordinated so that we don't have a region for each particular thing, but that we can make sure that we have some continuity in what we're planning here. So. That's my plea.
Chair Cowan, I totally agree with you, and I hope that, our intention is, as we put together this advisory committee in November and also as the local regions continue working in the HPP program, that we are going to pull in the EMS community much more than we have in the past, because they are a really critical link to that. And, you know, everybody, I know I don't have to talk to any of you about the budget issues that everybody is facing. That's going to be a challenge because there are some real needs for EMS that are of great concern to us. So we want to move that forward as best we can given the budget climate that we're facing.
But the end result always being what we're looking for is the best outcome for the individual who is under stress in whatever kind of a disaster or emergency situation they may be.
Chair Cowan, absolutely.
Senator Schrader, and then Representative Boone.
I just had a quick question. As you're working through these alignments and regionalization and coordination, have you involved the Red Cross? And if so, to what degree? Are they part of this whole? And again, I have a personal interest. I'm on the board of the Red Cross, and I know that they are doing tremendous outreach to make sure that they are an integral part of any emergency response. So have you worked with them directly, or what's their role?
Chair Cowan, Senator Schrader, I'm not sure I can answer that for you off the top of my head. I know that we have had some contact with them, and we do try to coordinate with them in crisis situations, certainly. I think it's a really good idea to make sure that they are integrated in with the statewide advisory committee and also the regional one as well, because they are a component of the health care that gets provided, potentially anyway, depending on the specifics of the particular response.
Thank you.
Representative Boone?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Cohn, you'll be happy to know that Clatsop County is at your service. In my little area of the district, we recently, last Saturday, had an all-day emergency preparedness fair, if you will, at the Elsie Fire Station on Highway 26, and all units were represented, and it's pretty widespread what they've been doing. They've got at least a couple of CERT teams, I don't even know what it stands for, Critical Incident Response Team. Mm-hmm. And then a number of local citizens have learned how to use a ham radio, and they're focusing on people who are staying at home in the fire departments and EMS service so that they don't have to rely on the people who should actually be out there doing the work of rescuing and all that. So there's quite a big effort in Seaside, Nehalem, Manzanita on tsunami preparedness, and you can translate that to just an emergency preparedness. They have equipment, packs, you know, they're getting people ready to individually be prepared for 3 days on their own, and they're using I was recently at a water conference, and a lot of the same methods and techniques of purifying water in developing countries are being recommended, you know, in these situations too. So we're definitely going to be ready on the coast, because we know we'll be cut off from everybody else, and so you won't have to worry about us too much, but don't forget us.
Thank you very much. If there's no other questions, I think we'll move on. I appreciate the update.
Thank you.
Stay in touch. Next up is Department of Corrections.
DOC.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Cowan, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing my organization to come here and speak today. I think they're passing out, as we speak right now, the answers to the questions we were asked to provide. We were asked basically to answer 4 questions prior to showing this morning some of the questions that were needed to be asked. And I'd like to just begin, if I may, with answering those questions, going through those.
Sure.
We were asked if our department has a business continuity plan, or COOP plan, BCP plan. At this time, our department does not have a viable COOP plan or business continuity plan. Did it include all of our field offices? Planning for that was inclusive into those field offices. We had a project plan and a project charter to address those, and also to be able to handle those in phase 3. Unfortunately, our project had to be put on hiatus during phase 2 because of the funding required to move it to the next step. We were able to get a lot of the initial parts of the process done prior to putting this project on hiatus. We had our Emergency Operations Center sited. Our agency's Emergency Operations Center plan was completed, and the agency's Emergency Operations Center manual was also completed, and it's presently being used by right now 9 different states, and about 14 other agencies in the state of Oregon are using our plan.
Excuse me.
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry.
I know. My oversight, I need to have you identify yourself for the record.
We both. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, you. Chair Cowan. My name's Captain John Lewis with the Oregon Department of Corrections. I apologize to the committee.
Thank you
sorry,
very
Chair.
Much.
And I handle the emergency preparedness aspect for the Oregon Department of Corrections and was in charge of the business continuity plan and COOP plan for the department. One of the other ones, if you do not have a continuity of operations plan, when do you expect to have one? Our organization does place a high value on the business continuity plan and also the COOP plan, so much so that it is on our strategic plan as a department, and it remains an initiative. This is the first time we've ever really placed a project into hiatus versus either terminating it or continuing on with it. The idea is that we plan to bring this project back out and fully move forward with it once funding's available. But unfortunately, at this time, to be able to come out and state when that date would be, precisely when we'd have that done, it's very difficult to say at best because of the funding situation. We were also asked question three. In the current environment today, you communicate by phones and emails. If we lost this method of communication, how would we communicate? Our department does have ham radios. Our department also has satellite phone capabilities. The unfortunate part was part of our comm plan was a communications plan was to test these in phase four. And unfortunately, we never got to that phase. We do have those. Those did operate during the Vernonia incident. Those did meet our needs for that time period. But to formally set down what is overload and when do they reach critical mass, we have not done that test yet. That was scheduled for phase four. The last part, does your agency have an operations center in the event of a disaster? Is your agency currently trained in the command system? Presently, the Department of Corrections does not have an agency operations center. They are what we'll be calling an EOC. We do have a manual for it. We do have a plan for it. As far as citing it, we did cite the primary, secondary, and alternate locations for the EOC. But as far as improving those and moving forward, there just wasn't the financial resources to do that. As far as training our command staff and our executive staff in the ICS system, most of our executive staff is familiar with it, but we were working towards certification in March of this year, basically certifying top down from director down to every executive in the organization, certifying them in the key and critical positions in the Emergency Operations Center. That also was put to a halt due to the budget restraints we faced. We do plan to transition our agency from the incident response system that we use right now, which is the Oregon Corrections Emergency Management System, and transitioning to a true 100% incident command system-based system. But with this being placed in hiatus, the timeline for that I can't really establish.
Okay. I think the question that has also been raised to me and that this committee has been assigned to sort of explore with all of our various agencies, not to put yours or any other one on the spot, but because it's imperative that we as a state think about how we are able to continue our operations in the case of the inevitable some sort of disaster that will befall us at some point in time. Have you been able to do any scenario workshop working with other agencies, developed any exercises of that nature that might test what you do have in place and figure out what the next steps would be as funding is available?
Yes, ma'am. We have done exercises with the local communities and also between institution to institution to see how that support system works. As far as on the COOP level of recovery-based exercises, we have not done any recovery-based exercises, nor have we worked with any other agencies because we haven't had anything to really bring to the table to be able to play at this point in time.
Okay. I think that's sort of the issue for us. We believe that we are, I don't want to say well-prepared, I'm stopping short of that, but most of us are familiar enough in some way with some sort of an event that's taken place in our communities that we are relatively confident that that initial response is in place and that our communities are very innovative and can step up as needed to deal with whatever the issue may be. But the long-term recovery of a major disaster is a huge problem, and the state needs to be ready to play their role as well. So I appreciate you clarifying that last piece. I think we're almost focusing more heavily on recovery as we look at where our weaknesses are than on the initial response. Are there any questions for this individual? So the sum total of the message is you've done what you could. You've run out of money for those kinds of exercises as we put ourselves in a holding pattern, and we know there's more to be done. Is that sort of a summary?
Chair Cowan, yes. That would be pretty succinct.
Okay. All right, then. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for your time. Mm-hmm.
So I think we will then move on to the Department of Administrative Services, who have had the same questions supplied to them in advance.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Hara. I'm the Director of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. You will likewise with the previous person testifying receive a copy of my written responses, but I do want to cover a few things before I go into that particular document. I wanted to provide a little background for you on the type of work that the Department of Administrative Services does in typical emergency response efforts. And in the past several years, we've had two opportunities that have really presented themselves. One was the December storm that hit the northwest part of the state, and the other one was the H1N1 pandemic. We played a slightly different role in both of those. For the Northwest Coast storm, our major role was a role of procurement. We purchased every blue tarp in the state and helped supply it to that part of the state. As a matter of fact, we were buying tarps from California and Washington as well to try to shore up the damage that was being caused by the continuing rains after the windstorm. We also were the major purchasers of water to supply to those communities that were without power and without fresh water supply. We do that through our procurement and coordinated with the Department of Corrections to make deliveries in using their warehouse to ship the supplies to, and then their trucking system to take them out to the communities that needed those supplies. We also worked in providing satellite phones for the emergency responders in those areas so that they could have communications. And then also we worked with Verizon to bring a mobile Verizon tower to serve the Northwest Coast area because those towers were down, as many of you know, because without electricity, your cell phones don't work also. So that's kind of a typical response that we play. We also assist the Anderson Readiness Center in communications, and we have some of our public relations folks that help staff that to keep the media informed during emergency of what the conditions are and what the changing situation is, and we play a role in that area. More recently, though, the H1N1 pandemic, we played a little bit different role, and that was also a communications role, but also as a single employer, we had a very large HR responsibility. There were a lot of questions that were being raised by agencies. Can I send a sick person home? What are their rights? What are the employer's rights, et cetera? How do I clean up biological fluids that might end up on the floor, so to speak?
We understand.
Yeah, thank you. And we developed a communications plan for each of the agencies so that on a weekly basis, agency directors could send out to their employees additional information to keep their employees informed. How contagious is the disease? How far does it spread? Is it airborne? Does it get into the HVAC system? Would it spread around the whole building? How long does the virus live on a surface? Do I need to have the whole area sanitized before my neighboring cubes can be occupied by employees? Those kinds of things. And by being proactive in those communications, we were able to accomplish a lot of things. Number one, keep the anxiety level of our employees down. because as Dr. Cohen provided us very good information, the virus did not live on surfaces for very long. The spread was very limited to around that person, didn't get in the HVAC system. We were able to share that information with employees to calm them down. So if one of their coworkers did go home ill, if they didn't get sick within 48 hours, they likely weren't going to get sick by coming to work, and that helped a lot. We also had a very strong effort to have people stay home when ill, because it was a very contagious disease if you did have contact with your coworkers, and we did not want to have entire work units lost due to the spread of the disease. So we worked very closely with Dr. Cohen's office and Oregon OSHA on providing that information so that we're consistent to the agencies on the protocols that they should follow in those different circumstances. The other major area that we have is more what we term disaster recovery in the state data center. As you know, we have about 90% of the state's computing power in a single location. And prior to the formation of the state data center, the state didn't have good disaster recovery planning. We have been working on developing that. We're still not where we need to be. Right now we have cold site capabilities, but to be perfectly honest, it would take us 4 days to get up and running if we were to lose the state data center. So right now we're working with our neighboring states in the western region to develop cooperatives so that we can actually be each other's hot sites. And we're talking in particular with the state of Montana, which has recently opened up two state data centers in their state. And both of them reside on a high-speed broadband communications line that would allow the rapid transfer of data between our states and allow us to in effect, store each other's data and have the opportunity to have hot sites and recover our computing operations much more quickly. We're in the early stages of that. Another thing that we're doing with the state data center is we have a very sizable backup generator facility out there so that if power goes out, it instantly kicks in. We have developed a public-private partnership with Portland General Electric. When Portland General Electric needs extra power, and sometimes in if they're losing power on the grid due to electrical storms or wind storms or whatever, they can access that generator, fire it up, and put power onto the grid. In return, they maintain our generator for us and fuel it and test it on a regular basis. So for us, we have move that cost of maintenance of those very expensive generators to Portland General Electric. They get a benefit because they have access to emergency power. So that is primarily what I wanted to cover on what wasn't generally covered in the questions. And so with your...
Absolutely. Okay. I think it's helpful for us to understand what you're trying to protect.
Yeah. Thank you. And I'll just go through the questions as the previous person did. And let me give you just a little bit of background on me. I was the sponsor of business continuity planning at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And so I helped develop the first plan at that particular agency a number of years ago. And myself and John Kreft from the Treasurer's Office actually went to DAS a number of years ago and encouraged DAS to create an enterprise business continuity planning or continuity of operations planning operation to help coordinate the development of these plans throughout state government. And that did happen. And then as it so happens, I later on became the director of the Department of Administrative Services.
Funny how those things happen.
Yes, yes. And as you heard in the previous testimony, as part of the budget cuts from leading into this biennium, that office was eliminated in our budget, and as was our own coordinator of business continuity planning in our own agency. So both the enterprise function that we had providing services and assistance to state agencies was eliminated, as well as our own coordination within. Now, I will tell you that a lot of what DAS does is manage crisis on a regular basis. So we're fairly well trained in a lot of ways. It's either a phone call from the governor's office or a phone call from one of you, and often we're into action. So But nonetheless, that enterprise operation was particularly missed. I received a letter from Max Williams, the director of the Department of Corrections, after last flu season, and it was a debrief of lessons learned from their part on the H1N1. And in particular, what the message to me was, he very much missed that enterprise function, feeling that agencies had developed their own game plan individually for dealing with the H1N1, and a template or some kind of guidance centrally would have been beneficial rather than having a number of agencies that all have to develop that work themselves. So that was a key learning from the H1N1 phase. Let's see. Communications by phone and email, and if that functionality is lost, very much like the Department of Corrections, we have access to satellite phones, we would use those. Another initiative that we're looking at, however, is right now in state government we have 53 separate email systems, and we're in the process of providing options for agencies to consolidate those down to fewer. And one of the options that we're exploring is a software service, or have an outside vendor provide that service. One of the benefits of that is they have two locations in the United States that basically will mirror each other. So if, so long as we have network connectivity, there's an opportunity that we have disaster recovery opportunities for our email systems by having them, A, not located in the Pacific Northwest, and B, having two separate sites in the United States. That's an opportunity that we're exploring and we're moving to. The Department of Revenue has already moved to that service. My agency is looking to move to that service, and in the work we've been doing with our sister agencies, I would say about half of them are looking at that opportunity, and the other half are looking at other ways to consolidate their email services. I don't know if that would be completely the solution for us, because if we don't have network connectivity, it doesn't help us. So, and then do we have a operations center in the event of a disaster? Because we do play a role in regional events, for a regional event, we use the Anderson Readiness Center. If we have an event that just affects our agency, we use the State Data Center as our center of operations. In part because of the redundant power supply that facility has. So be happy to answer any questions that you have. I went through that fairly quickly, but I know you have a full agenda today.
I think I'll start out by just helping me understand. It looks like a lot of the focus of what you do now, have done, are feeling fairly comfortably prepared to do, are focused on the response end of
correct.
An event.
Yes.
What about recovery?
And, Madam Chair, when we had December Northwest storms, a big focus of the governor's office, and I see Paul Evans in the room here.
He's just slipped away, so
oh,
you
did
can
he?
Say what
okay.
you'd like now.
All right.
He's queued up.
Was to coordinate not so much the recovery of state agencies, but of the communities and get them back and running. And that was basically done by pulling together agency heads of the key large agencies that could provide resources to those communities to help them recover. And our focus was on the recovery of those communities, not necessarily the emergency response. The emergency response, there's trained folks that do that. They were doing the work. They didn't need agency heads in their way. Our focus and thought was, how can we help those communities get going? Now, if you're asking about individual agencies and what happens if an agency loses a building or something like that, are we prepared? We have plans in place. We know we have an inventory of facilities and where we have space and where we can put people. We had the governor's office, for example, when the fire occurred, up and running on the following Tuesday. The fire occurred, I believe, on a Saturday night or a Friday night. Friday night, it was a three-day weekend. Mm-hmm. On Tuesday, he was back in business. So we do have the resources available when necessary. It depends on the circumstance that we need to address.
In follow-up, I would say that any disaster depends on the circumstance. We try to plan as best we can for all hazard sorts of events rather than focusing on one big thing. Although I think probably our next presenter will try really hard to focus us on one big thing.
Yes.
But as we close out this segment, we're going to be talking a little bit about the ability of the legislative branch of government to continue in the case of a major event. And the things we've been talking about and that have been described in the last few minutes have been significant events, but relatively isolated. The governor's office is out of commission. We can find a new place for the governor's office. But if we're talking the kind of event that takes down buildings or makes general government operations in Salem difficult, I think that's what we're kind of trying to get our heads around. As long as we, being the general group here, are functional, you can go out into specific communities and regions and help them restructure. But what if you aren't able to do that?
And we have, Madam Chair, we have looked at some of those scenarios. We have done tabletop testing on a subduction zone earthquake and tsunami on the Oregon, off the Oregon coast. The significant challenge there, and that type of event would have significant destruction into the Willamette Valley. You can look at the Good Friday earthquake in Alaska, and it's very easy to extrapolate the type of damage that would occur in Oregon in a similar type of situation. And one of our major challenges is the number of bridges that we would lose and trying to get transportation to different parts of the state. And I would tell you that general government operations would be secondary to the rescue effort and the supplying effort. And so we have looked at the governor's powers, and Paul's better on this, in an emergency to waive many of the regulations that we would normally do in normal course of business. Quite frankly, government would stop doing the day-to-day business and focus on the emergency and the recovery. So if you have a license due at the end of the month, we're going to waive that. We will let you continue doing whatever your business is until we can get back into a normal mode of operations. It doesn't make sense to try to stay very stringent on, well, you know, those do. Not dissimilar to when the Northwest storms hit, both of my bosses at the Department of Consumer and Business Services were out of country, so I was actually in charge of the agency when that storm hit. I signed an order that suspended insurance agents' ability to, or not agents, but companies' ability to cancel policies on those folks in the affected counties because mail services were discontinued, banking operations were discontinued, and so we gave the citizens of that part of the state leeway to until operations continued or resumed to start paying their bills again. It's a similar type of thing that we would do for government in saying we understand business as usual just won't continue for a period of time in an event like that.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other representative Boone?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to I know Dr. Cohen is he still here? Yep. One of the things that he actually hounded us about for an entire year, it seemed, was how simple it was to help prevent the H1N1, and that was by washing hands.
Yes.
And I'm interested to know when you get that many messages, and every time he came before us, he's always very nice, but he would always say that, you know, this is what you do. It really worked. I never got the flu, and I never got my immunization. I got the regular one, but I didn't get that one. So anyway,
and
I got it.
Really clean hands.
I did, and I did get sick overseas, but that was a different thing. But in any case, I'm interested to see if all the efforts that were made by Dr. Cohen and his shop to get out to the schools and people in the communities to wash hands, and that has that made a difference now? I mean, are they continuing to do it? Are we seeing a lowering of disease, that kind of communicable disease? This is something that's big in the developing countries too, that a big effort to teach people to wash hands. It's very similar, but there is on a day-to-day basis. So I'm just wondering if anybody's tracking that, or probably not your shop, but.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Boone, anecdotally, we saw far less number of folks out on sick leave in state government last time around. We don't check or track what kind of sick leave, what caused your sick leave.
Okay.
So at the state level, it could be because you're out for surgery. It could be because you have the flu. It could be a number of reasons. We don't track individually what the case is. I think Dr. Cohn probably has good information on that. I was thinking as I was driving in today, we need to send those reminders out again to our employees, because I think it really made a difference last time around, just anecdotally. I saw far fewer people out than I normally do during the flu season.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
Being a public health nurse, I was really amazed. Usually members, legislators, get sick. A lot of us get sick. Mm-hmm. But with the emphasis on the wash your hands and the sanitizing cleaners and people bumping their fists instead of shaking open-handed, mm-hmm. I think all of those things made a big difference.
Thank you, Dr. Cohn.
It may be time for your shop to send out that
I think so. It's
fall flu
fast
reminder.
Yep. And we are having our flu shot clinics right now in the state. So
there you go.
Well, thank you. I just think that's good. Let Dr. Cohn off the hook on that one this time around. So,
I see the sanitizers are still well and truly available,
sure.
And we have the new dispensers up in the building now. So the emphasis has not gone away. So. Thank you very much
Thank you.
For coming. Well, I have a feeling that our next presenter is just delighted that we've led so beautifully into what she would like to share with us. So we will move on now to the transportation reliability and the work of the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Committee. Now that I've said that, can we refer to it as OSPAC from here on out? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
My name is Mark Tyler, and I'm a member of OSPAC, and I represent school districts, community colleges, and universities, and I'm the chair of our Education and Communication Committee. I'm also employed with the Oregon Department of Education. Madam Chair, distinguished committee members, thank you for the opportunity for us to provide you with testimony today. Along with me is David Holton, representing the American Red Cross, and Yumei Wong, representing the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, or DOGAMI. We serve on OSPAC along with Representative Boone, and we also would like to thank you, Representative, for your participation in OSPAC and your continuing support in the promoting safety of the citizens of the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. OSPAC was formed as a result of Senate Bill 96 in 1999. The mission of OSPAC is to reduce exposure to earthquake hazards in Oregon, providing policy recommendations to the legislature. Oregon schools are in great need of seismic rehabilitation. Of the 2,100 schools that were evaluated by DOGAMI in 2007, over 1,100 are very high risk or high risk of collapse in a major earthquake. This places 300,000 students at great risk, as evidenced by recent earthquakes in other countries. As a result, the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program was established by the Oregon Emergency Management at the direction of the legislature. And they were provided with $30 million to start the program to seismically upgrade schools and emergency response facilities. Although the funding is greatly appreciated and a good start, it does not meet the timeline set forth by the legislature, which is on page 5 of the Cascadia handout. As public servants, we need to help protect students, and this effort became law through the legislature. And voters approved bond measures for funding projects. And in order to meet the 2032 deadline set by Oregon Revised Statute, an average of 55 schools per year for 20 years must be funded. In round one, 14 school projects were awarded grants to start or kick off the program, and it has proven to be very successful. This program is critical for the seismic improvement of schools, and therefore the number needs to quadruple to ensure completion in a timely manner. It is with the utmost respect that we ask for your support in our request for $200 million in the 2011-2013 biennium to enable schools and emergency responder facilities to protect students and the public. And thank you. And with that, I'll introduce David Holton with American Red Cross.
Madam Chair, committee members, good morning, and thank you for having us here this morning. The ability for our emergency facility buildings to maintain their structural integrity during and after a seismic event is critical to the response efforts necessary to protect lives. 100% of Oregonians rely on our emergency facilities to provide life-saving functions, disaster management, and emergency assistance to communities when disaster strikes. Any damage to emergency facilities from a seismic event can impair these life-saving response and recovery capabilities. As directed by 2005 Senate Bill 2, the Dugami report related to public safety, earthquakes, and seismic rehabilitation to public buildings identifies 983 emergency facilities within the state of Oregon and has estimated the replacement cost of these buildings at approximately $10 billion. These buildings include fire stations, police and fire departments, 911 centers, rural fire districts, county sheriff's offices, state police facilities, the Port of Portland, and acute care hospitals within the state. The number of low, moderate, high, and very high potential for collapse buildings have been identified using FEMA's rapid visual screening methodology. 249 out of 983 emergency facilities in Oregon, or 25%, have high to very high probability of collapse. 169 facilities have a moderate probability of collapse, and 585 have a low probability of collapse. Even the buildings assessed as having moderate to low probability of collapse are susceptible to damage that would significantly affect their operations. Hospitals have a high probability of disrupted service during a seismic event due to the complexity of their systems and critical life-saving support services. During the 1994 Northridge, California earthquake, building damage caused temporary closure, evacuation, or patient transfer at 10 essential hospital facilities and knocked 23 hospitals temporarily out of service. These hospitals generally had little or no structural damage but were rendered temporarily inoperable primarily because of water damage. At the majority of these facilities, water leaks occurred when fire sprinklers chilled water mm-hmm. or pipelines broke. There's been many comparisons between the recent earthquake in Chile, which our next speaker will address, and what Oregon may witness in a similar seismic event due to its similarities in building codes, geographic location, and proximity to the coastline. 100 hospitals in the area were affected, which is approximately 75% of all the hospitals in Chile. The cost of hospital damage alone exceeds $2.8 billion, and it's estimated that it'll take 3 to 4 years to replace the severely damaged hospital. In addition to hospitals, buildings housing police, fire, and 911 centers in Oregon could be rendered unusable, leaving many emergency service providers with the inability to provide a coordinated response during and after a major earthquake. The Dagami report has identified 213 buildings classified for this type of use that have a high or very high probability of collapse in a major seismic event. The Dagami report recommends buildings labeled as having very high and high relative seismic risks of collapse be prioritized for rehabilitation. Currently, 11 emergency facilities within the state have been approved to receive seismic rehabilitation grants for this year. It's OSPAC's recommendation that the governor and legislature approve $200 million seismic rehabilitation bonds in the 2011-2013 legislative session and dedicate these funds to the seismic rehabilitation grants program to significantly assist in upgrading many of the emergency facilities and schools at risk. It's OSPAC's recommendation that Oregonians should view any earthquake preparedness and planning as their most valuable asset and investment. The longer the delay in making seismic upgrades to emergency facilities, the longer police, fire, emergency service, public responders, and the Oregonians that depend on them in an emergency will have their lives at risk. Thank you.
With that, Madam Chair, I would like to introduce Yume Wong with Dogami. Yume?
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's an honor to be here to provide testimony on behalf of OSPAC. I'm going to continue our testimony with a slide presentation on the double disaster, Cascadia double disaster. We had an earthquake and a tsunami at the same time. And unfortunately, these nature's forces, you can't just use some Purell and wash your hands and get rid of it. It's one of these things that's inevitable, and it's going to be big, but not so big that we can't do anything about it. Okay, so the outline of our talk is such. We're going to do a quick comparison between a Cascadia event and the 2007 storm, also compare with Chile's recent earthquake, and then talk about transportation and energy, the importance of those to our economy. The highway system that we have is actually extremely vulnerable, and it's about a $1 billion problem to fix it, a long-term problem. We also are very dependent on our energy sector, electricity and liquid fuel and so forth. We have a project that is being, a new project that is being studied by the Department of Energy, the PUC, and Dogami. And then OSPAC has been working on schools and emergency facilities for about 10 years now, which Representative Cowan and Representative Boone, you're very aware of, along with Senator Courtney and others. Dogami has this report in 2007 out that indicates over 1,300 high to very high risk buildings. Schools and emergency buildings. This is, again, a big problem, $1 billion problem, no quick fixes. It's a long-term problem, and you've heard our recommendation for $200 million, and we'll substantiate that in a bit. Just to make sure we're all on the same page, which I'm sure we are, this is the fault that we're talking about. Very big fault. With it comes a tsunami. You've heard about our damage and loss assessments in the past where we're going to have a lot of damage. And we need to have, there will be a big response needed, and there will be a long-term recovery process from it. So comparing the 2007 storm, which isn't, that far in our past, with a Cascadia earthquake, a Cascadia earthquake is going to dwarf this storm. This storm started out with the storm surge. There was a windstorm, blew down trees and hit our electrical lines, flooded, our communication building for Verizon and so forth, flooded parts of towns. This is Tillamook. Had river erosion and landslides. But comparing this to a Cascadia earthquake, this is really a very small localized event. A Cascadia earthquake would be about 20 times the geographic area of the storm. The cost of that storm was on the order of $300 million. For a Cascadia earthquake, we're talking about $30 billion, so several orders of magnitude more in terms of cost. And the cost for fatalities would be significantly greater. In the storm, about 5 fatalities, and we're talking about 5,000, possibly significantly more fatalities in a Cascadia earthquake. And this is because the ground shakes for a very large area. The Chile earthquake that occurred earlier this year was a magnitude 8.8. The earthquake in Chile is depicted by this white box, and our earthquake is bigger than that and is depicted in this white box. Chile has very similar geology and geography to the Pacific Northwest. They have a subduction zone setting. They have the coast range. They have the valley. They have the volcanic range. They have very similar industry as we do, fishing, logging, agriculture, and so forth. They're just speaking Spanish rather than English. Oh, and they have a great wine industry. I hope that you're aware of that. one of the benefits to them is that they have earthquakes actually much more often. So they've had building codes, seismic building codes, since the early 1900s. So about 100 years before us. And they also have earthquakes so often that the culture there is quite prepared for an earthquake. They know what to do. And these earthquakes have actually winnowed out a lot of their very vulnerable buildings. So they were very lucky. I was down in Chile on vacation time with a U.S. engineering team, helped lead an engineering team and to look at the damage to the lifelines. And what we saw there is basically what we see in every earthquake. And this is the type of damage we should expect to see in Oregon. Damage in coastal areas hit by the tsunami, damage in areas where there's weak soils, such as by river bodies where there is soils that temporarily turn into liquid, like liquefaction, and weak infrastructure. A lot of structures that were built a long time ago were not built for seismic, for shaking, and they can fall over. So I'm going to show you a few damage photos from each one of these. Tsunamis, this is, boats get picked up and slammed around into bridges, and this area, actually, an area maybe half of the Oregon coast got uplifted by 3 feet, 5 feet or so. So this area permanently uplifted. This bridge, big bridge, actually got picked up and moved by the tsunami. And if you look under this bridge here, you can see that this whole part picked up and moved to the left and bent these members here. So you can see that this bridge actually is moved over in this direction. So bridges float, cars float, lots of things float. This is just the coastal highway there. Even the highway can be extensively scoured and the pavement can be moved. So on to weak soils. Weak soils, some soils tend to perform badly in an earthquake. This is a bridge abutment. This is part of their transportation system. I'm showing more pictures on transportation damage. This is just one of their wharves, and you know they certainly didn't build it like that. And weak soils along some more of the waterfront structures that deal with transportation, and one of their container ports. This is a classic picture of lateral spreading, where the ground liquefies and then it moves towards the open body of water, leaving these gaps. And it's quite evident just because of the asphalt. A couple pictures of the energy sector. This is a high voltage transmission tower, very important tower to them, built across a river crossing, and it fell over because of poor soils. And when it fell over, it brought two other towers like this down. I spent a couple of days at one of the oil refineries. These are the crude oil pipelines that bring in the crude oil. Both of the pipelines failed because of liquefaction and lateral spreading, and that refinery was down for 3 months, not just because of the pipelines, which are very easy to fix, actually, but because of other components, as well as their tanks, oil tanks with storage had problems. So there was a fuel shortage. I forgot to mention that they, after the earthquake, they immediately had a blackout, which is very common. On to the third area of damage after tsunamis, weak soils, weak infrastructure. This is an old bridge, beautiful old bridge. It's not expected to perform well in an earthquake, and it didn't, so it fell over. Lots of bridges were built a long time ago, lots of bridges built in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And they don't perform well. This is one along a coast. And this is a new freeway structure, just a few years old in Santiago, their capital, which is like our Portland and Salem. It's inland in the valley. This highway structure was new, went to their capital, and you can see that the top deck fell down. So ODOT breaks their bridges up into the deck part, the superstructure, the columns or the substructure. You can see that those are fine here, and then the foundation. So this is just an example where the deck fell over. They were quite lucky in many ways because their I-5 equivalent, they call Route 5, had two parallel bridges just about everywhere. They had two bridges because of expansion in the 70s. So when one bridge went down, oftentimes another bridge was fine. So they just had reduced traffic capacity, which is pretty good because they still had mobility. There's also a concern about overcrossings to their major highways. You can see that there is scaffolding here underneath. And this scaffolding is here because the bridge actually rotated counterclockwise a couple of feet. And I'll show you a picture where I'm standing right up here on the deck. You can see that there's been a rotation there. They're still using this highway, this overcrossing. They have limited traffic here, but it does take a lot of manpower to make sure that this overcrossing doesn't fall down in an aftershock and block the road. They had over 100 aftershocks that were over magnitude 6. And the transportation sector in general was compromised. This is their main airport, the Santiago Airport. Their tower structure had structural problems. This is inside their airport, and it's just their food court. I'm sure the food wasn't very good there anyway, but this is a real issue when you have suspended ceilings fall in places like hospitals because they require a sterile environment. They had 100 hospitals that were affected, and they did things they had very smart things that they did. They immediately released like 20% of their patients to make room for their casualties, and but they were still quite overtaxed. So what are some of the take-home lessons for us? We need to be thinking about the areas hit by the tsunami, weak soils, and weak infrastructure. Because we have so much weak infrastructure, because our building codes were so late to adopt seismic design in them, we know we can't fix everything at once. know, nobody's growing money trees in this economy. So we recommend a risk management approach where things are prioritized and make sure that anything we do is very cost effective, and so that we know that we're proceeding ahead in a smart way. All right, let's look at some of the damage in Chile versus Cascadia model. For Chile, they had only 500 deaths. This is a fabulous success story. This is not very many people who died. And again, it's because, you know, they're very prepared. And some of their other stats here, they were actually very lucky because their earthquake occurred at night, so people were at home. They weren't at work in these worse buildings, and they didn't need to figure out where their loved ones were. They were already at home. It occurred during an extreme low tide, which is very fortunate for the tsunami. The tsunami could have been much, much worse. And it happened at the end of a dry season, which means there's much reduced liquefaction and landslides. They had hundreds of landslides, but they were really quite lucky that there weren't any major landslides that took out major lifelines. For our predictive models, because a number of reasons, we have conservatively estimated 5,000 fatalities. And most of these would be occurring in the areas of tsunamis as well as in collapse-prone buildings. A lot of buildings will be damaged, but some of them will actually collapse. The type that collapses are the type that kill people. So we expect to have a lot of buildings damaged, about $30 billion of direct damage. So we put things here in terms of death, dollars, and downtime. These are kind of the crux of the matter when you have an earthquake. With deaths, we would be somewhere in between what happened in Chile and what happened in Haiti in terms of fatalities, on the order of 3 or so per 1,000. This is about what we had for World War II across the U.S. Across the U.S., this is over a number of years, and this was actually mostly military. As far as dollars, Chile had about $30 billion of damage to their economy, which amounts to 18% of their GDP. So they have a long way to go with their recovery. For us, if it's $30 billion, that would be 12% of our GDP. If what happened in Chile happened to us here, and they're quite better prepared, that would be about $70 billion. And that would mean about 50% of our GDP. There have been some adjustments made there. For example, our labor and construction costs, reconstruction costs are higher here than there, but they actually have more people there than here, so these types of adjustments have been made. As far as downtime, our economy is very dependent on energy and transportation, and the downtime will be controlled by how well our energy sector and transportation sector do. About 90% of our gas comes, 95% of our gas comes from the Puget Sound area down to this one place in Portland, which I'll be showing you a picture of. That gas is used mostly for transportation and energy. And what we expect with a Cascadia earthquake is transportation mobility problems, a fuel shortage, as well as electrical outages. And the goal here is to make sure that those are minimized so that we can respond and recover. This is just telling you something you already know. In Portland, we're a multimodal transportation hub. This includes the rail, the Port of Portland, airports, and highways, and so forth. And our fuel hub is also right there, which I'll show you a picture of very, very soon. So back to our recommendations. We should be thinking about our tsunami zones. This is Cannon Beach, a picture taken in 1964 after the Great Alaska Earthquake and Tsunami. Alaska tsunami hit us. It picked up this bridge here and floated it in. Here's part of it here, and here's part of it here. And it was replaced with a bridge that's going to have the same problem. This is what I mentioned earlier. This is where 95% of Oregon's fuel supply sits. It's on this red blob, which is all on liquefiable soil in Portland on the lower Willamette River. Really, all of our eggs are in this one basket here. If this doesn't do well, then we're going to be scrambling for fuel. And this basically is not expected to do well. Just a picture of it. This is kind of what it looks like. You have some of these very old docks, some of them built 100 years ago with 100-year-old construction techniques, and this is an example of it. If you wanted to build a porch in your backyard now, you would not be able to use this method. And this is what our fuel is dependent on. And many of the tanks are right up against the river here. Also in this area is a hub for our natural gas and our electricity. So this is a river crossing that is right in that same area. These two of these towers are owned by Bonneville Power Administration, and they recently did some exploration and analyses here for earthquakes, and they estimated that the ground here would move out by 25 feet. And this is these guys would be doing the splits. As far as weak infrastructure, we have a lot of weak infrastructure in our state. This is a bridge owned by ODOT, also in that area. This bridge would not survive a moderate earthquake. And the closer you look at it, the more problems you find from an engineering standpoint. The abutments, you're going to have liquefaction, the connections between the bridge and the approaches, the elbows can collapse into a single deck from a double deck. Just as a reminder, the 2009 ODOT report said basically that ODOT bridges in a Cascadia earthquake would have problems, complete problems along Highway 101. There would not be any connection between the coast and the highway and the valley, and sections of I-5 would be down. It's about $1 billion problem of damage, but what's really the big impact are the cascading effects. You wouldn't be able to rely on the transportation network in emergency response and in recovery. And then they went on to say that their current rate of fixing these bridges for seismic, it would take them over 200 years. And when OSPEC heard that, we thought 200, that's way too long. So we came up with a policy, and we shared it with ODOT and the House Transportation Committee just a few months ago. And basically, it's to come up with a plan and come up with a program. We're confident that in H1N1, where there's no shaking, the transportation network's going to be up and running. But in an earthquake, you know, during a disaster, we want the transportation network there. And right now, there's no plan that has identified good emergency routes after the earthquake shakes and considers the vulnerability of the bridges. We thought that, you know, there should be a plan put together and a program put together to address that plan. And we recognize that, it's a big problem on the order of $1 billion or $50 million per year for 20 years. And that's just to obtain a minimal network, not a robust network, just kind of a backbone network for some key arteries. And we're pleased to say that just as recently as a few months ago, ODOT has been working aggressively on putting a plan together. So we're pleased about that. These are some of the points that we had in our policy. One, you know, we recognize that ODOT is already, you know, thinking about this and to leverage what they already have. To identify emergency routes in the event of an earthquake. So not just emergency routes in a disaster, but what are the routes that would be viable in after an earthquake? Three, consider not just the shaking hazards, but when we have a major earthquake, we will have hundreds or thousands of landslides that occur at the same time, and a lot of them will block the road. and also consider tsunamis. Some of the coastal roads are going to be hit by the tsunami. Maybe there are some inland routes that are good possibilities to take to avoid that, and take a holistic approach. We have some critical infrastructure that we want to be able to get to after an earthquake, such as the fuel supply hub, and such as hospitals. So, you know, take into account the critical infrastructure, and then follow through with a program. This means having funding for ODOT to implement the plan, and then having a task force to oversee what's going on with the implementation. As far as energy reliability, just this year, there was a new project started, the Energy Assurance Project. It's funded by the Department of Energy. The state partners on that are the Department of Energy, State Department of Energy, PUC and OGAMI. The focus is looking at a Cascadia disaster and improving the energy sector's reliability. Our plan is due out by March 2011, and OSPAC has heard from this group and is supportive of this project going on. And then last, to schools and emergency facilities. On your written testimony, there are these tables shown on it. But just to recap, this is a table from the DOGAMI report, the 2007 DOGAMI report. There were over 1,300 high-risk buildings, high to very high-risk buildings that are prone to collapse. Last session, you generously provided $30 million to provide for seismic grants that are being handled by the OEM, the new OEM seismic grant program. In the first round, which is half of that money, they issued 25 grants to schools and emergency facilities. They needed to turn away a lot of people because there wasn't enough money. And, you know, this minus this means there's still, you know, 300 and still over 1,300 buildings that need to be fixed. This is, we recognize, a big problem, a long-term problem. In order to fix the high-risk and very high-risk buildings by 2022 for emergency facilities, which is the statute, the state law, and to fix schools, public schools, high-occupancy public schools by 2032, there needs to be a big investment to help fix these. And this is the schedule that OSPAC put forth. We're recommending that the investment be $200 million in the next biennium. That would provide about 3,300 jobs. That assumes fixing 55 schools per year, and that needs to be done for the next 20 years, and 24 emergency facilities per year for 10 years. So this investment would need to be sustained over a 20-year period, and it is obviously you know, big investment for core infrastructure. We either pay now or we pay a lot more later. The mitigation ratio for the cost-benefit ratio in general for mitigation is defined by some national economist groups. It's a 4-to-1 benefit-cost ratio. So either pay a dollar now or $4 later. Okay. So, in summary, geologists don't have a crystal ball on when exactly the next earthquake and tsunami is going to be, but in geologic terms, the Cascadia is like 9 months pregnant, and she's going to have twins. Earthquake and tsunami. Engineers, on the other hand, do have a crystal ball. It's a little murky, but we know where the damage is going to be in areas where the tsunami hits, weak soils, and weak infrastructure. OSPAC has a new focus, which is on transportation and the energy sector. There are new planning efforts being done by ODOT and the Department of Energy, PUC, and OGAMI in this area. And so I would say it would be good to keep an eye on the progress being made there, because it's so important for our economy and our standard of living. As far as schools and emergency facilities, this is been a 10-year priority for OSPAC, who have worked with many of you and Senator Courtney. It's at the heart and soul of OSPAC. Schools are, and emergency facilities are core infrastructure. Everybody, 100% of Oregonians depend on emergency facilities to be there for them. And so we're asking for very large investment over a very sustained time period for these very important structures, starting with $200 million in the next biennium. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Yumi, and thank you, David. With that, Madam Chair, we again appreciate your allowing us to provide testimony today. And as you are well aware, this is a huge issue that that we as Oregonians must address sooner or later. And so with that, we're open for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Just for the committee's reference, would you be able to electronically share the slides of your presentation with the committee? That would be the preferable methodology, if you would, so we can have it in our files. Thank you. I have a quick question. I'm wondering if we need to do some follow-up at some point. There's a fairly significant amount of highway construction and bridge retrofit going on right now within the ODOT structure, and I know they're taking into consideration seismic issues, but I guess basically from your group's perspective, do you feel like the new construction that is going on is going to meet the standards that you're looking for?
I can take that. After OSPAC heard from ODOT, we've been in pretty close contact with them, and from my understanding, with the current expenditures, phase one of the bridge retrofits are being conducted when ODOT is working on a bridge. And what phase one means is they are tying the bridge decks to the columns. They're not addressing the columns and the foundation. Mm-hmm. So if the ground, say at the river crossing, which is why you have the bridge there, liquefies, then their mitigation is not addressing that. They're just doing the lightweight, cost-effective approach on the deck structure. Now, what they are not doing is addressing the network as a system. So they're not looking at what are the most important routes to be secured and fixing them in a prioritized manner. They're just addressing the bridges that they're addressing for other purposes. So, for instance, if you wanted to get from point A to point B, you wouldn't be able to do that with the current method that they're using. And they are, very cognizant of this, and this is something that they would like to figure out in the plan that they're working on. One of the things is,
can I do a follow-up?
Could we jump in with a follow-up here?
Yeah, I'm aware of some of the transportation pieces that we've passed in the past, OTIA 3, OTIA 1, 2, 3, okay. And a lot of that was directed towards bridge repair. And what I'm hearing from you that there was no policy in place to prioritize a system-wide approach to evacuate people when these, there's no set criteria that actually helped pick the bridges that were going to be repaired that actually based on a system-wide approach of evacuation. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Schrader, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Other questions? Representative Boone.
thank you, Madam Chair, and great job, you guys, all of you. A lot of information, and it reminds me of the first days of this committee when it was joint back in 2005, and we were hearing the stories about tsunamis and from Dr. Goldfinger and leading up to our seafloor mapping efforts, which we have made a huge inroad into about getting half of it done. I wanted to first thank you all, but you may went on our own dime and own time to go to Chile and look at these similarities that we're going to have. So it's really helpful to see the slideshow and see what we might expect since they're so similar to Oregon and what we might experience so we can really get a grip on it. And one of the things that keeps popping up to me is it's like in anything, when we ask for money for things, it's getting something done or providing a service and people actually do it. So that to me says this is a jobs program and we'll be providing thousands of jobs. And I'm sorry, with all due respect to you, May, I'm thinking you're talking, we should be talking more than 3,300 jobs. I think there's going to be more realized by this. But I'm not going to doubt your numbers, but that's just my thought. And I think that we're lucky that we've got the federal government money to address the energy sector needs, and now we need to follow up with the rest of them, that we know these things are necessary. We know we have to do it. And in light of our economic woes and everything, if we can prioritize something that's going to save lives and continue our economy in that sense, or allow us to continue it as soon as possible, albeit in a limited manner because we'll have a lot of damage, I think that this is rising to a top priority position. And I support it. I think that it's very important for us to support it. And I hope that you all feel the same way, because as she said, we'll either pay now or pay later. And we know the coast is going to be cut off. I know the Quartz Creek Bridge is going to be down. That's the tie line between the North Coast and the Valley. Down below all the other bridges, we will be literally trapped, as we were during the storm and had the water up. That went down. When the water went down, we could drive through. This isn't going to happen this time. So thank you very much, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I believe you've painted a picture for us, so we appreciate your time this morning, and in the interest of keeping us on schedule, unless there are pressing questions here, I think we'll move on. Thank you for coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, about 10 minutes in order. Manny, finally, for this segment, the emergency services piece of our committee this morning, we're going to revisit that issue of the legislative ability to continue operations after a major event. We have in place the structure for disaster declaration and the very appropriate way in which the governor moves in to orchestrate the initial response. What we don't have in place is a way for the legislature to pick up their end of the responsible, our responsibilities in the operation should we be, as a collective body, many of us unable to come here and meet in this building as we, in the normal manner that we're called into an emergency session. So we've kind of dealt with this off and on a number of different occasions, and it hasn't really gone too far. To this year, time around, we have before us LC 257, which was in your packet, and Legislative Council is here to help walk us through what this might or might not be, and maybe some of the pitfalls that we ran up against when we've tried to address this in the past, and how we might do it more effectively this time. Thank you for coming.
You're welcome. Madam Chair, members, I'm Ted Reutlinger with the Legislative Council's office, and I thought that what I'd do is just quickly walk you through what LC 257 is and what it does. It's based on Senate Joint Resolution 6, which was introduced in the 2007 legislative session, and what it is a constitutional revision that proposes a new article to the Oregon Constitution, and it gives the governor and the legislature new and relatively vast powers to override existing provisions of the Oregon Constitution in the event of a disaster. And as you probably know, a revision to the Constitution is different than a simple amendment. A revision can make multiple changes to the Constitution, and it requires a two-thirds vote of both houses of the legislature to be referred to the people, as opposed to a simple single amendment, which just needs a majority vote to be referred to the people. So what does it do? First, it allows the governor to declare that a catastrophic disaster has occurred, and then once that happens, the governor and the legislature have new powers that they don't have under the current Constitution. How does it work? Well, first of all, the governor must declare that a catastrophic disaster has occurred, and LC 257 defines what a catastrophic disaster is. It's a natural or human-caused event. It can be, and it gives examples, terrorism, war, illness, flood, tsunami, things like that. The list is not exclusive. But in order for the governor to declare a disaster, there has to be first the event, and second, there has to be two results. One, an extraordinary level of death, injury, property damage, disruption of daily life. And two, it has to severely affect the population, infrastructure, environment, economy, or government functioning of the state. So it could apply differently. If there's an earthquake in Portland, obviously all of those factors could come into play, and the governor could declare a disaster. If the earthquake of the same magnitude is in the middle of the Al Gore Desert, you're probably not going to have the same effects, and it wouldn't be eligible for disaster. Once the governor does make that declaration by proclamation, the governor then, under this, is required to immediately call the legislature into session. The next thing it does in Section 2 is give the governor new authority that the governor doesn't have under the current Constitution. First of all, the governor can direct general fund money that's been appropriated to executive branch agencies for any purpose related to the disaster. Second, the governor would be able to redirect lottery money that has been allocated to executive branch agencies for purposes of responding to the disaster. And this gubernatorial authority would continue until the legislature passes a law that says that the governor doesn't have that authority anymore. Section 3 changes legislative procedural requirements that are currently in the Constitution. It lets the legislature do things that it can't do. For example, it can meet in a place other than the state capitol. It changes the quorum requirements. In other words, two-thirds of the people who can manage to get to the session constitutes a quorum, as opposed to two-thirds of everybody who's in the House or in the Senate. Changes the quorum for suspending the rules for bill readings to the same thing, two-thirds of the people who are able to actually attend. It allows bills and joint resolutions to be passed by a majority of the folks who can make it to the session, not simply a majority of the people who are members of the House or the Senate. It allows bills for raising revenue to be passed by three-fifths of the members who can attend, as opposed to three-fifths who are in the body. It allows the legislature to put an emergency clause on a tax bill, which they can't currently do. And then Section 4 addresses actions that the legislature may take that are otherwise prohibited, substantive actions. For example, currently the legislature can't spend state highway fund money on anything but highways. This would allow you to take highway fund money and spend it on something else. This would allow the legislature to appropriate monies that would otherwise be refunded to people under the kicker provisions, for purposes of responding to the disaster only. It would allow the legislature to exceed the state debt limit. It would allow the legislature to override the local mandate provisions of the Constitution by a three-fifths vote of people who are able to attend a session. It would allow you to use lottery money for any purpose and in any ratio. Now, of course, the Constitution limits the purposes that you can use lottery monies for. And it makes it clear that nothing in this affects the authority of the governor to veto legislative bills. Finally, Section 5 addresses how this override of the Constitution is ended. What it requires first is that the governor recommend a date that these new powers be terminated, and then the legislature has to pass a bill to say, by law, to say that these constitutional powers granted under LC 257 are over. Finally, the bill may include transition provisions in it that allow some of these new powers to continue in order to encourage an orderly transition back to regular time. And that's basically it. It does a lot. It's a relatively important list of provisions in the Constitution. There are things that you could add, things that you could take out. This doesn't override all of the provisions of the Constitution, obviously, and you could pick and choose to include things that aren't in here or take things out that currently are.
Thank you. I appreciate it. The question that's called for here is a huge question that will be debated. There's no question about that, no doubt of that at all. And we have before, and those conversations have not been successful up to this point. I think it's important that we point out and get on the record that this catastrophic disaster is a very narrowly defined situation that we hope we would never have to face. The challenge is that we are not prepared, should we have to face a disaster of this magnitude, that there's any methodology for the legislature to take some of these kinds of necessary actions without the appropriate majority quorum, whatever, being able to be here in this building. And I think, from my perspective, that's an oversight and something that we've not addressed within the state as to just exactly how would we manage to continue the appropriate levels of all three branches of government if we should be facing a truly catastrophic disaster event. So I think it's appropriate to take this forward for conversation, and I'm sure there will be much more discussion to come, for the committee's understanding or my understanding. What is the status of this LC at this point? Is it anticipated to be developed as a committee bill, or?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. Mr. Taylor could probably answer
Taylor,
that
no,
better.
I'm not exactly sure where we
Madam
are.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this was drafted in behalf of the House Emergency Preparedness and Veterans Affairs Committee.
So what you really need from us today is clarity as to whether this committee wishes to take it forward as a committee bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as far as the House is concerned, as long as we have the draft request in by the 27th, that's sufficient to meet that rule. At some point, it could be now or December, yes, you could make a determination that to forward it into the next legislative session as a committee bill.
Okay. Comments, questions of the committee?
I'd like to ask a question.
Representative Escobar.
The attorney. What is extraordinary levels of death, injury, and property damage?
Madam Chair, Representative Escovill, obviously this does not define that, and that would be left up in the first instance to the governor who would have the authority to make a determination that there has been an extraordinary level of death, injury, or property. I presume that the governor would not proceed if the governor didn't feel that there was a defensible position there, an explanation to meet these definitions. You could, if you so chose, further define that in this resolution. Also, somebody in theory in court could challenge a gubernatorial choice if there was some question about whether or not the disaster rose to the level that was contemplated by this provision.
Follow up?
Thank you. Follow up?
I assume Section B is the same thing.
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, yes, it would be.
So in other words, there's no definition.
There's no definition here. And I, in going through the file from 2007 and looking at some of the amendments that were considered by the committee then, I found that there was interest in defining the phrase that's used in this many times. It says throughout this resolution that monies can be used if they're necessary to provide an adequate response to the catastrophic disaster. And there was interest in further defining that term. But I didn't find any evidence of a desire to define the to further refine the definition of catastrophic disaster.
Representative, I think your questions reflect exactly the conversation that would have to take place if we choose to take this on. Mm-hmm. Those are that's where the challenge is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Roetlinger, if this were enacted by the people, would it be possible for the legislature subsequently through statute to more adequately define these terms?
Madam Chair, Mr. Taylor, I think the legislatures clearly would have the power to fill in the blanks by statute as long as they didn't conflict with what this says. And at first glance, I don't see any reason why the legislature by law couldn't further define it as long as it was consistent with the intent of the language of this resolution.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't want to open the discussion of the issue at this particular point in time. What I'd like to see from the committee is whether there's a willingness to tackle this conversation. Yes. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll say along those lines, and we won't debate the issue, but I do think that if we're identifying, yes. By the way, extraordinary level of death as if something happened to me, but I would say, though, that identifying that there's a need or at least a review of something that's missing from statute, that it would be our responsibility to exercise and entertain this concept. Whether or not we support it today obviously remains to be seen, but supporting the concept moving forward and trying to work through this as a committee, I'd be committed to helping you through that.
Thank you. I'm putting before us a very difficult question, and I know it. I just happen to think it's something that we have a responsibility to address. Representative Boone.
And maybe this is a point of clarification. I'm not trying to delve into it. If we did not do this, are we mainly talking about expediting getting resource to the problem with this bill or with this resolution and getting it? For example, if we did nothing and operated just as we are now, in order to get the resources, financial resources and whatever, what would it take? Would it take a special session of the legislature to consider that, or can the governor just do an order or whatever?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, it would clearly require a special session of the legislature if the legislature needed to change the law and appropriate additional money to agencies. It would also require legislative action if you wanted to change the purposes for which money that's already been appropriated could be used. You know, right now, if you appropriate X number of dollars to the Department of Human Resources, the governor can't take that money and spend it on something else. This would allow the governor to do that. So it really does allow a much quicker response, both by the executive branch and by the legislative branch. In this case, the legislative branch could convene with whomever is able to make it to the session and take action under rules that are vastly different from what you have now, rules that would accommodate a smaller group of people. So if the disaster did not prevent the legislature from convening, you clearly could call under the current law a special session and do whatever you would normally do. If the disaster prevented members of the legislature from getting to Salem, this would allow the legislature to still take action, whereas currently the Constitution would not.
Thank you for putting that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, is I guess I'm just simply going to, in the interest of time, ask if there's an objection to moving this forward for further conversation. Thank you. Thank you for your help, and I have a feeling we'll be chatting with you more.
All right. Thank you.
With that, we're going to take a brief break. Let's try this again to allow setup for the next section of our meeting. So we stand in recess.
Recess. Okay.